Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. We are in the dog days of August when activity can feel sluggish, but that's certainly not the case for financial markets. The S&P 500 is coming off of its best week in 4 months, while bond and forex markets have had no shortage of volatility. With a flurry of economic and earnings data, policy news, and continual developments in AI, there are plenty of factors contributing to these market developments. Joining me here today from the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS FSI, glad to welcome back Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas, Jason Dreho. Jason, hope you enjoyed some restful time away. It's great to have you back here on the podcast. A lot to catch our listeners up on, so great to be with you on this Monday morning. Welcome back.
Thank you, Dan. Happy Monday. It's good to be back. Appears during my time off, the markets did well, so maybe that's a sign I should take more time off. We'll see. We'll get more data points on that, but that was a positive development.
So on that note, Jason, let's talk about the markets and the good equity performance as well as the volatility in other asset classes. What has been taking place recently and what are the factors driving this market movement?
Well, let's just start with what actually happened, especially over the last week, because if you take the S&P 500, last week it was up 3.6%. That was its best week since mid-April, when kind of the appears of the worst of the Iran-U.S. war was kind of getting over. Strong bounce back, but it was fairly broad based. In your small cap equities measured by the Russell 2000 was up kind of a comparable amount of 3.6%. The NASDAQ index was up just over 5%. A lot of it was led by AI and tech related sectors. So like NVIDIA was up 11.5%, Microsoft 8%, and other parts of the all kind of broader AI kind of related complex all up 5% plus. But it was also, kind of a more broad-based measure in that cyclical stocks outperformed defensive stocks by roughly kind of 4 percentage points. So why was this? There's a few factors. One, maybe increasing investor confidence that there would be another sort of period of ceasefire between, U.S. And Iran. That contributed to oil prices falling, roughly, 9%. That helped, yields, treasury yields to decline, across the entire, yield curve. So that was sort of, kind of beneficial. They were down, a little bit, last week. And really, if you go back over the past, almost 2 weeks, expectations for the Fed, hikes have gone down. So, September, that's declined to less than 50% chance. Some of it is kind of, geopolitical news. Some of it was, good earnings. We've had a very strong earnings season, so we'll get into the details, a little bit later. And then also on Friday, it was, a jobs data point that was kind of below expectations, but the markets sort of interpret this as perhaps bad news is good news. So some fundamental factors, some factors about, policy, just kind of, all the kind of driving the markets higher. But there's also the fact that this was coming after a period of time where July was very choppy. You saw a lot of rotation beneath the surface. So even though the headline index, the S&P 500, was relatively range-bound and never fell more than about 2.5% sort of peak to trough, beneath the surface there was massive rotations with like the momentum factor selling off very, very significantly. Investor positioning that had been quite engaged or elevated had de-risked a lot. And what happened last week was signs of investors, especially institutional investors and hedge funds, kind of re-engaging, kind of adding back exposure, maybe even to some extent chasing the upside, because there was more fear of the downside and the market sort of resuming their grind higher. So just as one data point, last Tuesday, there was record call volume on the S&P 500. Investors are buying calls because they anticipate upside, so that's an indication that investors very quickly pivoted to wanting to chase the upside. So all those things kind of led to, a bigger, week in early August, even though it is sort of the dog days, market's a little bit quieter, a lot of people on vacation. Some of that lighter, volumes and activity means it's also makes the markets a little more prone to perhaps reacting to, sort of news than it otherwise would be. And last week was a positive, story kind of overall.
Quite a number of factors, Jason, you outlined. You did mention economic data as one of the driving factors. Thinking back to this past Friday, we did receive the July jobs report, and this week we will be receiving July inflation prints. Can you summarize, Jason, the jobs data for us? What happened, and what are you expecting to see in this week's inflation numbers? And what might this all mean for the Fed's monetary policy outlook?
Well, starting with the jobs report, it was certainly well below expectations. The July payrolls number fell by 23,000. And that was well below expectations, where consensus was around 50,000. It was also coupled with downward revisions to the prior 2 months for May and June. Combined, those were revised down by 103,000 jobs. So the three-month average of job growth is 20,000. Prior to the report, the three-month average was 111,000. So this is clearly kind of a big decline, and so it would suggest that the job market wasn't quite as strong as the data coming through the second quarter would have indicated. It's not bad. This is 20,000 is kind of in the range of what a lot of economists would say is sort of a break-even level for the labor market, meaning how many jobs need to be created every month in order for the unemployment rate to stay stable. These estimates vary. Some are as low as basically zero. Some might be as high as around 50 to 60,000. 20,000 is sort of within that range. That's reflected by the fact that the unemployment rate actually fell 4.1%, and it fell because of a falling participation rate. This is not entirely unexpected. We have two key structural drivers that would be leading to a falling participation rate. One is just demographics, is people age. In the population ages, you're going to get fewer people working, and that's one factor. Another is with net immigration this year being probably negative, you have sort of less supply coming through immigration. So that's leading to less supply in the labor market, so you just don't need to create as many jobs. So 20,000 a month, like that is sort of, perhaps you could say, kind of in the range of sort of the new normal of what it is for the labor market. Some additional details of the labor market report also give a little more comfort that the headline number is not as indicative of a real sort of weakening. A lot of the job loss was in government, but also leisure services. On government, some of those that's maybe the seasonal statistical quirk of kind of government layoffs this year versus prior years. And in leisure services, there was perhaps hiring related to the World Cup that took place in June and early July. As that eased off, perhaps you could see some kind of leisure services pull back a little bit. So not a good number, but also perhaps not as bad as the headline number would indicate. Another key data point in the jobs report was wage growth. On a year-over-year basis, the average hourly earnings fell to just over 3.1%, and the month-for-month level was quite low. This was sort of coupled with another data point last week, which is the quarterly employment cost index. That's a really broad measure of overall kind of wage costs for employees, whether it's salary, bonus, things of that sort. It fell to 3.1% in the second quarter. That's the lowest in a number of years. So you're seeing definitely some softening of the labor market, sort of less bargaining power, but not kind of outright weakness. If we look at other data points just on the consumer, that would be tied to the labor market. Spending remains solid, and also investment remains strong. So overall, economic activity remains still relatively solid, despite that jobs number on Friday being disappointing. Looking ahead, the focus this week will be on the inflation data, starting with the CPI data that we get on Wednesday, and then the PPI data for July that will come out on Thursday. Consensus expectations is that the headline number will still be quite low, as the benefits of gas prices moderated, still kind of flow through, although the benefit won't be quite as strong as in June. The key focus will be on the core CPI data. If anything that's around 0.2 or 25 basis points, it sort of will be in line with the headline or the year-over-year number for core CPI going lower. Consensus has a 2.5% for core CPI year-over-year. Last month it was 2.6%. As long as it's moving in the right direction, it's another reason why the Fed should be willing to stay on hold for September. Another factor is I mentioned the wage growth being relatively soft. That is ultimately some factor in kind of a long-term sort of inflation pressures. That's another reason why we think the Fed could would give the Fed some reason to pause. Market pricing right now is for about a 45% chance of a hike in September. as a result of the weak labor market report. It wasn't so weak that the Fed could now put equal measure, we'd say, on the labor market and the inflation or price stability aspect of its dual mandate. But it certainly, you know, makes the job, the Fed's maybe decision a little bit easier if you see some weakness in the labor market, see weak wage growth. And if we get an inflation print for July, that's relatively contained. It certainly won't make September pause a done deal, but will make it much less likely, barring some really strong data in August suggesting otherwise. So overall, you know, the data from last week is consistent with our view that, you know, U.S. economy is growing around, you know, trend of 2%. Inflation will continue to moderate, and the Fed will be on hold this year, not have to raise rates at all.
Outside of economic data, there has been a lot of focus on the Q2 corporate earnings season, which is beginning to wind down. Q2 earnings have been very strong. So what are some key highlights and takeaways that matter most for the investment outlook?
Well, the fundamental story from like a labor market perspective could look fine, not great. But the earnings story has been nothing short of kind of spectacular. We do have about 90% of the S&P 500 companies who've reported. And the second quarter earnings per share is on pace to grow about 30% once you exclude some of some one-time investment gains for Google and for Amazon. So very good numbers overall. A lot of this is due to semiconductor stocks and boosting earnings growth, energy companies that got a benefit from higher oil prices. But the median stock is still experiencing 12% earnings growth, which is one of the best quarters in a few years. So very, you know, good numbers overall, but it's also kind of relatively broad-based. But looking forward, you know, that's kind of, you could say, is already kind of priced in. Looking forward, you know, what matters is the guidance for these companies for Q3, but kind of ongoing. And oftentimes, as earnings season plays out, companies guide for the current quarter, so in this case Q3, lower, then ultimately kind of beat the numbers in the subsequent quarter when the numbers actually come out. So far, we're not seeing those downward revisions. We're actually seeing earnings revisions for Q3 go a little bit higher. And so bottoms up earnings expectations right now are still having 20% earnings growth in the third quarter and even in the fourth quarter. So, you know, this earnings momentum, you know, is likely to stay very strong for the, you know, the rest of this year. One of the consequences of that is the actual valuations for S&P 500 has gone lower, because you're seeing equities, you know, yes, they reached an all-time high, but earnings growth this year is far surpassing the price performance. So the forward multiple, the, you know, based on the next 12 months of earnings expectations, has actually gone from a 22 PE to down to about, you know, 20, given these very, very strong earnings numbers. Now, one thing that is interesting about the results, it's a little bit of, you know, kind of arrive and travel and arrive, meaning the markets that are anticipating really good numbers that contributed certainly good performance, you know, in, you know, through, you know, June, less so in July, but as a result of really good numbers and sort of beating expectations, we actually didn't see, you know, stocks popping a whole lot. For stocks that beat both on their earnings expectations and sales expectations, they did outperform the market overall on the following day after they reported, but only by about 80 basis points, which is just over half of the historical average. What this entails and what it means is that the markets were expecting good numbers, the companies, you know, delivered, and it's kind of shrugged off to some extent to that overall result. But the key story is very good numbers, forward-looking earnings stories remains very, very positive. That is a key fundamental driver for why we remain constructive on equities, both in the U.S. but also abroad.
Now, a topic, Jason, that you and your colleagues have written a lot about and have spoken a lot about here on Top of the Morning is the AI economy. It's a continuous, fast-evolving topic. What are some recent developments that you find to be most noteworthy?
Well, as you say, like, this is, you know, fast-evolving. The key in narratives and debates about how this whole AI development, the spending, the implications, the consequences, you know, those can change almost month to month. And so, and, you know, a topic that I'm going to, you know, address on a regular basis on this call is like, how is that narrative playing out? Because it is clearly driving a lot of the economy, as we laid out in the report, but also, you know, the equity market performance overall. And so given that earnings season is largely done, I just wanted to highlight, I think, a few interesting sort of takeaways that we can get from that earnings season and other developments over the past few weeks. And the first is that what we're actually seeing is a result of the earnings season is that your companies are showing an ability to monetize this disinvestment. That we're seeing kind of clear examples of kind of enterprise, you know, use of AI. You know, these are sort of, you know, generating, you know, sufficient and kind of measurable returns. you know, more than enough to cover the cost of, you know, the tokens, cost of compute. That is one of the big concerns. Like, you know, is there going to be a return on investment? So companies are seeing these benefits. That's a positive sign from what we think is kind of the AI flywheel of companies have to see the productivity benefits. If they do, the demand for compute will go up. The demand for compute goes up, then that justifies, you know, the CapEx spending that we're seeing. So the ROI on that CapEx investment remains relatively attractive. A development over the past month or two that's certainly going to become a question mark in the minds of investors is these open source models. Many of them are Chinese. You know, if you have open source models that are essentially free to use for companies to use them, does it sort of undercut the value proposition of frontier models? That might be a little more advanced, but definitely sort of more expensive. And there's a lot of CapEx being spent to justify both the inference, the development of those models, but also the applications of those. What it looks like, though, is kind of the notion of this Jevons paradox, that as you you make an application or a tool less expensive, it actually increases the overall demand because now companies can get more benefit and they're more likely to willing to invest. And there's evidence that we're seeing this kind of play out. All this is reflected in the performance of stocks. You know, we're seeing the hyperscalers, but also more clearly the semiconductor stocks kind of benefiting. Same with the application layer. I think the real question mark remains with some of the model providers, because of how they will, ultimately kind of monetize some of their development costs. Another key story in the whole AI kind of economy, but also investing is, the financing. A lot of money is being issued, on the debt side to finance this CapEx build out, whether it is investment grade corporate bonds, private credit, some sort of securitized finance. There's essentially a huge demand for capital. We've seen spreads for some of these issuers kind of widen out, and there's kind of a question whether is there enough appetite among investors to to fund all this investment without spreads going and yields going higher. And so we've seen spreads wide for some of these hyperscalers, but they've also tightened a little bit. And I think companies and issuers are sort of conscious of concerns about cost of capital. And there are situations where these companies are sort of providing guidance to investors that as we come to issue $10, $20, $30 billion of investment grade corporate bonds, that this might be a one-off, that they won't issue again this year to sort of signal, for investors who are looking to get attractive yield, that it's also not a infinite supply. I think that's also helping to tamp down some of those concerns. But it is becoming an issue. I think so far it's well contained. But when I think about the two key drivers of the whole AI economy story is you need to see the productivity gains, the return on investment. That's, we're seeing, some real evidence of that. Financing could be a constraint. Without the financing, this could be, constrain the ability of the investment cycle to materialize. But so far, that hasn't been the case. We're seeing companies being able to raise the capital if necessary. That could certainly change, but at the moment, through this part of the summer, that has not been an issue overall. So certainly more to come in the coming weeks and months on these topics, but I think that's some interesting takeaways from particularly from the second quarter earnings season about the AI economy and where we're headed. It still feels very much sort of, all momentum is in a positive direction for the time being.
Now, taking into account, Jason, all of these factors you've shared with us, let's talk a bit about investment recommendations. Now, coming off of a good week for the equity markets, what are CIO's key investment messages and recommendations at this time?
Well, one of the key messages, we like equities kind of across the board in the U.S. and globally, but it's also to sort of diversify across equities and not to be, so concentrated in some of these tech stocks. We've seen over the past couple of months a real broadening out of performance, whether it's looking at an equal weight S&P 500 index outperforming, small cap stocks kind of outperforming, other like more cyclical sectors outperforming. There is opportunity to do well in equities that doesn't require being concentrated in a handful of AI-related stocks. So that's, we think that will continue to play out. And the earnings story is beneficial. The Fed not hiking as those expectations come down, that's also beneficial to some of these more cyclical and non-AI parts of the market. So that's one key message. We've said to seek opportunities in commodities. Gold, we downgraded the neutral a couple of months ago. We did see gold last week up about 8%. It had sort of, been sort of reaching a floor around 4,000. For year end, we have a price target at 4,600, but by next June, we have it at 5,200. What's noteworthy is that a lot of investors were on the sidelines, whether it's institutional investors or certainly retail investors on gold after the big pullback. Last week, there were reports of the Chinese Central Bank, the PBOC, actually kind of went out to buy gold. And then, you know, data points and anecdotes of investors then starting to kind of re-engage and realize, like, if the floor is in and there's upside here, and that sort of structural trend to maybe de-dollarize questions about sort of, you know, Fed's, you know, kind of commitment to fighting inflation, that's kind of renewed a little bit as the Fed did not hike, you know, a couple of weeks ago. That sort of provides, you know, structural tailwinds for gold. So even if it doesn't necessarily, you know, perform over the you know, the rest of the year, like, significantly, we still think on a more medium-term basis, it remains quite attractive as a diversifier overall. So those are a couple of key messages that we hit the dog days of summer for investors to kind of keep in mind as they think about, you know, any adjustments to their portfolios for in the very near term.
Well, Jason, always a very helpful touch base. Great to be back with you here on Top of the Morning. Thank you again for keeping our listeners informed on the factors driving market movement and how to position accordingly. And as always, do look forward to picking back up with our conversation in the week ahead.
You're welcome. Have a great week.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/cio-disclaimer.